in Buddhism, Buddhism's very, very rich kind of teachings, lots of texts and books and so on, and it's got a very long history. It's a very rich teaching. One of the ways we talk about it is pariyati pati 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 vedi, which is study, practice, and realization. It's a bit like baking bread. You read the recipes, you get inspired by whatever, and if I said something, someone would make something for tomorrow, so... so you read the recipe, right? And then you get inspired. Then you start to work on the recipe. You get the ingredients. You mix them together. Get the oven to the right temperature. Bake the bread. Then you taste it. And you eat it. So the studying of the recipe is necessary. But if you just study recipes, you're never going to have the bread. And that's where... if one just leaves this teaching at a kind of intellectual level and constantly maybe debating about different points of the teaching, that's all very nice and good, but you'll never taste the bread. So the baking and the mixing of the ingredients we call bhavana, or practice, and there's many aspects to the practice. Some of them are the lifestyle aspects, living a life of... virtue, a life of morality, altruism, generosity, those all kinds of lifestyle issues, and there's lots of teaching around that. What I'd like to ponder and consider are two words we have in our teaching, samatha vipassana. Samatha I define as meditation, and vipassana I define as contemplation. Meditation, contemplation. Words, I mean, you'll have your own definitions around, I mean, you'll have your own feelings and perceptions around meditation and contemplation, so I'll just try to explain them, because words are really very relative, aren't they? Meditation is what we just did now. That's what I would call meditation. Meditation is like walking on a log. You get a log, put it up maybe a foot on... you raise up a log and you learn how to walk along the log. You get on the log and then you try to do it and you fall off and you come back again. You do it 10 times and you can go back and forth on the log. If the log's slippery and wet, it's more difficult. But basically, if you just stand there on the log, before you stand on the log and think, how am I going to do this? You'll never learn how to walk on the log. You'll have good ideas. And if you're on the log and you're thinking about how to walk on the log, you'll fall off, won't you? So to actually walk on the log, you have to walk on the log and fall off and figure out how to balance yourself, right? And much of meditation is that. It's just very practical and very difficult, because it's a slippery log oftentimes. And, you know, when you want to walk on the log, it's raining or snowing or whatever, or your boots don't fit or whatever it might be, but... It is really, meditation is just, you just have to do it. There's no, some people are very adept. You know, I've had a fair bit of experience of watching monks and lay people. Maybe 10% have kind of really gifts towards meditation. The rest of us, 90%, struggle with it, right? And if you find meditation a struggle, don't see that as extraordinary. That's fairly ordinary. Because the... it is a kind of training of the mind which we aren't inducted into. We usually use the mind either for just a lot of thinking, or we learn how to concentrate from excitement or from fear. You know, we concentrate on something quite interesting, like, you know, downhill skiing or something. We get very concentrated because it's exciting, it's interesting, it's beautiful, and so on and so forth. But to actually compose the mind on something neutral and make the mind calm on something within your body, say, that seems to be quite difficult for human beings. I'm not saying it's more difficult than downhill skiing. I don't know. But there is a degree of difficulty there, because there is no because we try to do this without fear and desire. Because if you put fear and desire into your meditation, then the result won't be good, because you're putting more fear, more desire. So you might be able to concentrate on something very dangerous But maybe you need that danger to be concentrated. So we're trying to take something very neutral and very ordinary and learn how to compose our attention on it and calm our minds on it. Samatha practice. So that's a kind of rough way of talking about meditation. Contemplation is more like bird watching or vipassana. The vipassana is a kind of word you find, which is a pretty hot word in Buddhism now. And it's used in different ways, but I just look at it quite simply as contemplation. We have the ability to contemplate. We have the ability to reflect on what it means to be human. I can reflect on what it means to have emotions, what it means to be incarnate in a body, what it means to have thought, what it means to have intention, what it means to have a personal history. All of these things are a part of the program or the experience of my life. And I can reflect on that. I can observe it. I can not only feel physical pain, I can also observe my reactions to physical pain. I can not only remember a past event, I can see my mind fantasizing about a past event, right? So I have this ability to reflect, and that's the power that of the human consciousness, which the Buddha was really encouraging, the ability to reflect, the ability to step back, ability to get out of the storyline. Huh? It's very important in Buddhism, this ability to reflect or contemplate. And so why I say it's like bird watching, it's like the, you know, if you take up bird watching, you get a field guide, maybe you get some audio tapes, and maybe you get someone to explain it to you, and then you go out to High Park, and your bird man or your bird woman says, "Well, you see all those ducks out there. You see the ones that have the punk haircut? Oh, that's a hooded merganser." And then you look up in your little book, Hooded Merganser, and you get your field glasses out, and you see there is a it's not all mallards out there. There is this funny looking duck which has this kind of pointy haircut. Oh, that's a merganser. Yeah. And then you start to watch the merganser and you say, oh, the merganser dives like a loon. And it fishes in groups. And you begin to understand mergansers. You understand certain kinds of ducks. Why? Because you had a field guide. Someone said, hey, look at this. And you actually looked. You were present. You weren't just kind of daydreaming about something in Hyde Park. You actually looked at the pond and the ducks. It's the same with a Buddhist teaching. He presents a project. First of all, you have to understand the project, the Buddhist project. There is a goal. It's not just being nice. Being nice is a part of it. There is a goal in Buddhism. The goal is, via negativa, it's freedom from suffering. Positive way, realizing deep compassion, deep love, deep wisdom. A possibility that the Buddha presents to us. So that's the basic project. Enlightenment, if you want. If enlightenment sounds a bit too grand, freedom from suffering, we all want to be free from that. Freedom from greed, freedom from hatred, freedom from delusion. Vice versa, the true understanding of life, deep peace, love. So the teaching partially is that there is a goal in Buddhism. Then the teaching lays out the path. There's a way to do this now. Right? It's not just the Buddha kind of realizing it's something, saying there is ultimate truth, and then leaving the party. He's taught for 45 years, and he laid out a very, very good path, a very good really, I find it very clear, very helpful. So then you have the path, how to do this. And part of the path, part of the doing, is developing a mind which can be present in the moment. And this is, if you observe just maybe this meditation or whatever, you observe your own consciousness, how difficult it is to not continually dwell on the past and the future with all the storylines of self. So what say this meditation that we did now, it very, very simple of trying just to be with bodily sensations. And what we're trying to do there is, first of all, we're trying to pay attention to life as it presents itself now, not with a whole filter of commentary. And if you look at your own mind and how consciousness works, how much of there is this constant judging or commentary or fantasizing or regretting or remorsing or resenting or hoping or expecting, all this kind of verbalization of life around the present moment, and how much of this moment is actually noticing the merganser or feeling the wind or tasting the orange or whatever it might be. So this direct perception of life, direct contact of life, can be rather difficult for human beings if we are caught up with thought. Thought is a good tool, right? Thought can be a good tool. So planning and problem solving and all, that's fine. But if thought, if we don't train our minds to be present, we can very much just be addicted to thought. And it's all very well and good if you're feeling happy, so you can have happy thoughts, right? But the downside of that is when our emotions go wonky, go a bit off, then if we are addicted to thought, then those negative emotions are going to be manifesting through thought, and then the thought perpetuates a negative emotion, and negative emotions perpetuate the thought. You get this vicious cycle. So someone who might be very happy, but they've never really trained or look at thought, trained to be in present moment, some kind of awful family situation comes up and the mind goes into worry because they haven't trained the heart, haven't trained the mind, then the worry propels thoughts, and the thoughts make worry, the worry makes thoughts, and the whole mind just gets spun out in a very suffering kind of way. That's an extreme example. So if we choose an object of meditation to see it as a way of simply training to be here and now, that's one big step in meditation. And if you look at meditation as a training, rather than trying to get some kind of experience, this is the danger of meditation, is that you read about profound experiences that people have. Or maybe you've had some profound experience or a really peaceful experience, and the mind gets into a kind of a desire to get something. And as soon as I observe the present moment with desire to get something, I'm in the past, looking to the future. I'm not in the present moment. I focus from a memory. So I meditated 2 months ago and I had a really lovely, loving experience, and my mind was very clear and empty, and it was all one, and my ego fell away, da-da-da-da. And then I'm sitting right here and now, 2 months later, and I keep trying to get that back. Oh, I want to get that. So then I certainly focus on my breath, or I focus on my body, or do whatever I'm supposed to do, but it's full of desire. It's not really awareness of the present. It's got a whole agenda. It's a hidden agenda if I'm not aware of it. So in meditation, we always have this kind of Zen mind, beginner's mind attitude of beginning again. What is it like now? What does life feel like now? How does this moment feel? And that is an entry into the present moment without history, without desire, without any sense of becoming, but simply knowing, this pure knowing. And that's really the heart of Buddhist practice, pure knowing. And the way I tried to introduce that was listening to sound. It's a very, very good way to bring yourself to pure knowing, listening to sound. Just you have ordinary sound of this lovely heating system, and you listen. But you have to listen to the sound rather than think about the sound. There's a difference, isn't there? If I say that's a lovely heating system, that's not the sound. It's a thought, right? And that kind of filter, we want to get away from that filter, away from the commentary, to the direct experience of just sound. So you just listen. If you do that for a while, your mind is composed in the present moment. Your mind begins to really experience the present moment. It's an ordinary sound, so it's not like you're listening to some beautiful piece of music that really draws you. Just very ordinary. And it could be beautiful, it could be ugly, it doesn't really matter, it's just pure listening. Right? Now if you can enter into the present moment like that, and begin to know what that's like, just knowing sound, then you have the basis for what you're trying to do with your meditation object. You're trying to be present with your meditation object. Right? So, begin with sound. Then in this meditation I also use mantra. And mantra is very helpful because it preoccupies your thinking mind. If you want to develop meditation and really get a kind of a good pattern going, what you'll find is that you sit down and your mind will be thinking about work and about the kids and about the family, naturally, because the mind has been engaged with that. And usually you need some very, very deliberate kind of exercises to be in the present moment. So mantras, Jesus prayer, prayer of the heart, bhajans, different traditions use different things. Poetry, sutta, agatha. But it's something that you have to engage your attention in a very meditative way. It's not just a sort of abstract thinking. So you take a mantra, it requires breath. So if you take a mantra and you really use it with deep breath, and then you really focus on the words, focus on the breath, focus on the group, that keeps you grounded in the present moment. Whereas if you just sit down and say, I'm going to meditate, and you don't make some clear determinations, you don't make clear decisions, this is what I'm doing now, what you'll find is your mind will just be past and future. You know, some old memory will come up, and you pick that up, and you get a brilliant idea what you're going to do next week, and that'll be fun, and then the bell will ring. Right? And then you think, oh, where was I? So you have to be quite deliberate in kind of saying to yourself what you're doing. But it's not like you're forcing yourself, because that is a mistake that people make. You just try to dominate the present moment with a kind of willfulness. Then you hate meditation, you just want to go away. That doesn't work. So it's like what the language I find most useful is what it's like awakening to the present moment, or opening your mind to the present and holding your attention in a sense of awakeness. So that's why I use sound. You awaken to sound, and I'm not trying to dominate the sound in the room. I'm letting it come to me, and it's very peaceful. Very peaceful. So then you turn to the object of meditation, having done the mantra. Right, as a way of ground. I mean, and these are just suggestions. You don't have to do it this way. But what I'm hoping to maybe remind you of is that there are kind of good tools and good techniques in meditation that help you really get grounded in the moment, because it's one of the very difficult things with meditation. So a mantra is a possibility, or a gatha, or I was talking to a Trappist monk who comes and visits us at the monastery, and he's got a lovely Jesus prayer that he uses, kind of a series of things, and he just keeps repeating them, and because there's a lot of devotion in it for him, that devotion and the language and the kind of having done it and knowing how to do it brings him to that sense of peace. It's a kind of tool he's used, right? So also with mantras, you'll find if you develop them and use them, they're the kind of hyperlinks into peace. You know, the problem with the untrained mind is that all the hyperlinks of negativity are being triggered. You know, you're just sitting there and some memory gets triggered and you're off into resentment. You know, you find, and then the bus stops and you have to get off. You're on this web page of resentment. Then you're walking along and all of a sudden another hyperlink and you're into the web page of anxiety. Oh, tomorrow, what am I going to do tomorrow? And then you trip on the ice and you're back home again. Right? So the unchained mind keeps going to these awful web pages. Anxiety and fear and self-disparagement. And then there's a nice one of fantasizing about buying a new CD or whatever. But it's basically just kind of, you know, random web pages. You're the kind of victim. So what we're doing in meditation is we're developing truly like these links to really skillful states of mind. So if you use a mantra, for example, or if you see what I mean, if you see the principles, you know, I'm not saying you have to do it this way, but if you understand the principles of how the mind works, so imagine if I've done a mantra for 20 years and I've really worked at it. You know, when I pick up that mantra, I have the whole body of energy and memory to take me back to that peaceful state of mind. Because I've cultivated that, I've worked with that. So the mantra reminds me of that peacefulness of mind. Right? And so with methods of meditation, you obviously have to find a method of meditation which you find simpatico with you, you know, that you that resonates with you and that fits your character and so on and so forth. So there's a bit of a struggle that way, finding something that kind of works for you. But if you do find something that works, then you have to work on it. I like skiing, but I have to learn how to ski. I like baking bread, but I have to learn how to bake bread. So then you have to work on it. So you work on it. And so you give it, you know, it's a 20, 30 year project. Give it some time. Really work at it. Then what you do is you begin to have this really way of entering into the silence of the mind, the peace of the mind. You really have these kind of hyperlinks. Because the peace of the mind is always there. It's just covered over with a lot of noise and confusion and bad habits. Bad habits, really. So training the mind like that, you can recollect. In Buddhism we say recollect the beautiful, recollect the wholesome, recollect the skillful. Because you've trained the mind by using a particular object in meditation, you can use that to remember that state of mind, to keep coming back to that. So the suggestion then is like a mantra to begin with might be helpful. Then choose the object of meditation. Make it very clear what you're doing. Don't just kind of have a vague idea, oh, I think I'll meditate. Make it really clear, because what really awakens the mind is intention. When I make an intention to awaken, I awaken. Now, so you make an intention, when you sit down, okay, for this half hour, past or future, I'm not going to go there. I'm going to be with the moment. You have to be very, very diligent in that, but not kind of harsh. Because what you'll find is as you meditate, then that brilliant idea about the project which you're going to do next week will come up. And that brilliant idea is a lot more fun than the breath. And then the mind will think about this brilliant idea, and your mind will be scattered. Right? So you have to renounce the brilliant idea. Or that really resentful thing which you really need to think about and really hate this person because the person really deserves your hatred, I really have to do that now. No, you have to renounce that too. So you give up past and future. Now they will come up. They'll come up as memory because we have memory. And if you get a very strong upwelling of memory with a lot of emotional impact, you can look at that as a present experience. If I have a really inspiring, exciting idea of the future, I can look at that as a present reality rather than as a whole bunch of stuff in my head for the future. So if I can feel it in my body. Or if I have a really awful memory of some cruelty that's been done to me and that comes up, I can feel it in the body. But the suggestion is always don't take it into the head. Don't take it into thought. Come back to the body. Come back to the present reality. Because if you take it into thought, it's endless. The fantasies are endless. They're all clever, obviously. I wouldn't have a dumb fantasy, me. They're all beautiful. They're all, you know. and all those resentments, they're very truthful. You know, profound resentments. I don't have petty resentments, not me. And so on. But if you take it into thought, it just goes on and on and on and on. There's no end to it. If you reject it, if you hate yourself for those things, and you just try to control your mind, that won't work either. Because it's not about control, it's about training. So you have to accept the fact that the mind has restlessness and unskillful states which will arise, okay? That's a given. That's just part of the training. It's just like I'm going down the ski slope and my knees are weak, or you know, I lose my balance, or I haven't got the right wax in the ski, or whatever. It's just part of it. So you accept the fact that these negative things will come up. But if you learn how to feel them and not pursue them with thought, then they resolve themselves. So you might feel a memory of sadness, but if you feel the sadness, it is just a present experience of sadness. It's nothing more or less. You don't reject it, so it's not repressive. Neither do you pursue it. So this is the middle way between repression and indulgence. You're not repressing, you're totally accepting, but you're not taking it into thought. So we say acceptance is one of the keys to meditation. You really accept what's going on. So then you choose the object of meditation and then you train with that. You really just train with it. You know, it's just like a musical instrument. If you want to learn how to play the flute, you play the flute. And you develop the coordination, all that. Same with the breath. So it's like walking on the log. Right? You walk on the log and you lose your balance. And that's just a basic training which one has to just do daily. Day in and day out. And you won't get much success if you do it once a month. I spoke to someone the other day and they said, it used to be so good when I meditated 15 minutes a day. I said, what? 15? That's nothing. I mean, come on, man. What are you doing? 15 minutes if you can't give more than that. And I was quite disappointed in his character because he's got a lot of time. He doesn't have family or anything. And yet, I was wondering, how much time does this guy spend on the net? You know? So you do, you know, I don't want to lay a heavy trip on you, but I will. You have to put high priority on it. You know? You have to put high priority. But it does have, you know, it's incredibly beautiful space, the inner silence of the mind. It's just such a lovely space. And once you kind of get going, and that's the hard bit, get going. You know, to actually sit down and stop just for half an hour, people find incredibly difficult. There's always, gotta answer my emails and the kids. So obviously, the most difficult is if you have small children, then it's really hard because you know you want to meditate and they're throwing ping pong balls at you or something or jumping at you. So you just have to give it up for a few years. But to see that it is a difficult discipline, so there is resistance to it. This is what I'm finding when I talk with people, and the resistance comes because, because it's difficult to do. I suppose it's like playing the piano, or whatever. So you have to go through that. So it does require some kind of self-discipline. Yeah? So you have to kind of set up a time. Set it like, you know, half an hour or 15 minutes if you want. Okay, that's a start. And then do it. Become hell or high water. You have to really do it. And then as you start to get good at it, you really get disinterested in the net. You know, music gets less and less interesting. Novels get more and more boring. Because there's something, you know, very, very beautiful about the inner peace of the mind. But it requires that kind of training. Now, this little meditation that we did now, I kind of kept poking you, didn't I? Say nose, shoulder. So I kept kind of waking you up, I hope. Or maybe I put you to sleep, I don't know. But, so there's this kind of character telling you, wake up. That's basically why I did it. You know, it didn't really matter if you noticed your elbow or not. Hopefully, it brought you to the present moment, right? But you got to do that for yourself. And this is what you'll find, is you have all good intention to meditate, and the bell will ring. And your mind will just have gone off for whatever amount of time. Don't worry about it. The more you make the intention to wake up, the more you wake up. You just keep doing it. Now, this body meditation is a very, very good meditation because the body, first of all, is a present reality. It is happening. Right? So it's something which really informs you about the present moment, the body. The body's feelings, its tensions, its pressures, whatever. The body reads the emotions very nicely. To feel fear in the body is brilliant. To think fear is endless. So if you can get to know your emotions in the body, it's absolutely brilliant because you can really process your emotions through the body. Love and hate, fear and desire, all these things. When you're losing mindfulness, when you're not present, if you cultivate a lot of body awareness, you'll notice how that any loss of awareness is tension, is suffering. You'll notice that even minor fantasies are tension. You see, the body's not relaxed. So The reason there's a lot of body meditation in Buddhism, they use the breath, they use body sweeping, posture, all those kinds of things, is that, first of all, it's a part of the present moment. If you can look at it without desire, it can be very, very calming. And then it becomes the sign itself of the uncalm mind. Because when my thoughts go off with aversions or fears, my body's registering that too. And if I practice a lot of body awareness, as my whole system is going off into some form of suffering, you really notice your body getting tense. Obviously, we all know that. But it gets more and more refined, you'll find. You know, you get like just any slightest kind of nuance of aversion. You just immediately you're seeing it in the body. So it becomes this really lovely way of monitoring delusion. Of monitoring the unskillful habits of ego. It's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And the body likes it. And it's free. We all get sick and we all die. Huh? Now, right at the end of the meditation, I said, feel the body. And I asked to feel it rather than perceive it, think it. There's a difference, isn't there? When I think body, it's a kind of abstract 6-foot thing. Right? But when I feel body, before I think about it, what is it like? It has no definition. It's always changing, isn't it? Vibrations, heat, pressure, even that. It's just words. It's just this movement, and it's an object of knowing. And then I said, listen to sound. And then I said, feel the body. And then I said, listen to sound. Now, you think you're the body, right? But if you're really observing that, you'll see that the body is an object of knowing as the sound is. That's weird. That's very strange. But what you begin to see is the body is a force in nature, is a changing energy in nature, and that knowing is your real home. And that knowing is peaceful, and that knowing doesn't need anything, and that knowing just knows. And that knowing, we say, when you begin to take that knowing as your real home, you begin to find true peace. Feel the body. I'll finish and then, okay? Feel the body, listen to sound. Feel the body, listen to sound. So in the Thai forest tradition, we say, be the knowing. Be the knowing. Now, if you cultivate that sense of just knowing or witnessing or being aware or whatever, right, around something very ordinary, like your shoulder, or like a sound, something very neutral, very ordinary, and you train in that, then when something powerful and negative comes up, like an anxiety attack, like depression, like anger, maybe you have something really powerful, your refuge is in the knowing, and you can bear witness to the anxiety, the fear. And it'll go through you. It'll go through the body. You'll feel it. But you've got a place to be with it. You've got a way of processing it. And when you can process these very more difficult things that get triggered off by various life's events, then that knowing gets even stronger. You get more and more confident with it. In that knowing. In that knowing, doesn't really matter the quality of the experience. When you have pain in the knee, the knowing is the same, but then desire arises. So you have the desire for pleasure and the aversion to pain, right? That's what happens. Reflection on the body can teach you about that. You can have desire for pleasure, like discomfort in the body, and not to take it to self-torture, but you can feel discomfort and you can abide with that knowing. If you abide in the knowing of discomfort, there's the desire to get rid of it, but you don't follow the desire. You just know desire. You know desire. You know aversion. And when that aversion ceases with pure acceptance, when that desire ceases with pure acceptance, you have a very deep kind of peace. Because you haven't looked for peace in an external thing, in a bodily experience. You've just allowed that knowing just to know. And you find this deep peace. And that knowing is where the spiritual center lies, we would say. In Buddhism, we say mindfulness is the path to the deathless. Awareness is the path to Nibbana. That's the spiritual center. And so in our meditations, around the body, around the breath, what we're cultivating is not a particular kind of high experience, but we're cultivating this knowing, this awareness. And this awareness is what we're trying to do all the time. In committee meetings, walking on the ice, baking bread, whatever. Awareness, awareness, awareness. We're always talking about that. Awareness is not a quality. You feel sad, you can know that. You feel happy, you can know that. The knowing is not, hasn't a taste, hasn't a color. It's not big, it's not small, it's not male, it's not female. It's not young, it's not old. It's not Islamic, it's not Buddhist. It's just this. It's just this knowing, this clarity of clear presence, pure presence of mind. So even if your meditation is seemingly like, you know, you feel a complete basket case, you know, you're nodding around and you're just trying to sit up, just the fact that you can just be with that is good practice. So please don't be careful not to judge a meditation as a good one and a bad one, because that'll be a real setup for the next one. But just see, well, this felt awful. This is what it feels like. This is what an awful meditation feels like. And just accept that, right? Rather than think, oh, I'm a basket case, you know, I can't meditate, I'll never be able to do this. Don't get lost in self-thought. That's just a thought. What does it feel like to have a bad meditation? The knowing is the same. And then you have a successful meditation, finally. You know, it all comes together and you feel great. Don't believe it. It's just a feeling. This is what it feels like to be enlightened. If you buy into that, it's just, this is a feeling, like I'm successful. But don't, if you get caught into, oh, now I've got it. You know, I've really got it. You're going to lose it. Because the changes, the experience changes, but the knowing doesn't change. The knowing is the knowing. So sometimes you really feel peaceful. And if you keep letting go of the quality of the experience, what you find is you keep coming back to the knowing. And you see that knowing is very, very profound and very peaceful. But if you just get caught up in the experiences, pain and pleasure, you'll always be kind of being thrown around. So if your meditation is restless, fine. Just accept restlessness. Acceptance is a really key to good meditation. If you feel pain, accept that. If you've got a lot of thought, accept that. Keep knowing it, keep knowing it, keep knowing it. That keeps taking you to deep peace, that kind of acceptance. Okay, I think I've talked enough. The contract was till 9 o'clock, but maybe a few questions? If anyone wants to go ahead. But yes?
You talk about mantra.
Yeah.
And should it be said loudly? Or is it only to be said in
both? Mind? Both. Like if you're having a coffee at work, maybe doing it loudly isn't good. So you do it to yourself. But like when I'm on my own, I love to use the voice. I love to use sound. I love the energy of sound. So do it both. As long as you do it mindfully. Don't do it like a parrot. You know, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato, you know, kind of. People can do that, just kind of parroting it. Really do it. Really do it. If you're going to do it, really do it. And then, I like deep breathing. I can get really loud in my own kuti, but obviously I can't do it. Where people, you know, I don't do it in the airport, say. So try it, an experiment, try it. The best thing about the whole path is it's very creative. There's no, you know, there's no fixed way to do it. So if you have a kind of intuition, I might try this, try it, give it a go. You get a lot of confidence that way. But to have a mantra under the breath, in Thailand, Thai Four tradition uses Buddha, Buddha, which is the vocative of Buddha. And they just keep that going, but very alive. The Thai tradition uses that a lot. But whatever tradition, you know, you can be very good. Because it preoccupies the thinking mind. Alright?
Could you elaborate a little bit more on contemplation?
Bird watching, okay. Sorry. It's like let's say, The Buddhist says that there is suffering, and there's a cause of suffering, and there's an end of suffering. And he indicates what the cause of suffering is. And he indicates what the end of suffering is. So you study that, which is the Four Noble Truths. And he says there's a path which leads to the end of suffering. So you read the text, you read the book, you memorize it, you listen to tapes, you talk to them. You start to get an idea of suffering. An idea, okay? And then you live life. And then you suffer. And as you're suffering, the teaching comes alive. Like the bird book. The Merganser. Suffering. Where is the suffering? What is suffering? And you start to look. And what is the cause of suffering? The Buddha says, the cause of suffering is attachment to craving. So you've got that in your mind, having studied it. And then you say, what's the cause of my suffering now? And maybe your body's hurting. What's the cause of my suffering? And you remember the teaching. Teaching says, attachment to desire. Attachment to desire. You start to look, you look. You can't just be thinking, you have to be looking. So your mind is silent, but you're looking. What is desire? What do I want now? You look, ah, I don't want pain. You get insight. Contemplation, looking, and then you see insight, ah, I don't want the pain. What if I just allow the pain to be there? You let go of the cause of suffering. Oh, I'm relaxed. It's okay. Now that whole process is one that takes a certain amount of study, a certain amount of thinking, but not always thinking. So the thought then around this particular teaching is, why am I suffering? And then you have to be silent. And then you have to observe, you have to be aware. Why am I suffering? Oh, I see, I'm resisting this pain. Ah, I see, that's insight. And then what does that resistance feel like? So you might have a bit of thought, but you're actually, it's not thinking. It's observing this bird that the Buddha suggested we look at. Observing this aspect of life. And you say, oh, I see, that's what he means. Then you get the insight that the Buddha had. Then you begin to see Dhamma, and when you see Dhamma, you're like the Buddha. You've seen the truth the way things are. And so the teaching's very vast, and it talks about all kinds of wholesome states of mind to cultivate, unwholesome states of mind to abandon. There's all kinds of things. But it's that ability to observe life through a theme, through some ideas, but not just be thinking all the time. Because it's not just about thought. The experience of insight comes from direct seeing. But the focus, it's kind of like the Buddhist teachings, like the binoculars, right? The study. So the binoculars is going to focus you in on the animal. So your awareness, the teaching, the samadhi, all focusing on the problem. And then you see the problem, you see the solution. And then you have the realization. And that, I think, a lot of people don't understand contemplation. They either think that you just kind of meditate yourself into nibbana, so you just kind of meditate, just try all the time, or they think that it's just thinking. So they're just thinking all the time. And then they have discussions, and then they think, and then they ask questions, and they think. But what I'm indicating, it's seeing directly, but with the Buddhist teaching in the background, right? And so study is necessary. And that's why in say the contemplation of the body, what I'm suggesting is like begin to have direct contact with the body. Not just thinking about my knee, but direct feeling of it. And then you'll begin to have direct contact with the aspects of the teaching, like suffering or discontent or whatever it might be. You see it directly without the filter and commentary of analysis, of thought, of judgment. You're going to see it directly. Yeah? And I'll speak about that more in the next 2 days. Anyone else before we put in our bird books? Yes, I'm sorry, I missed you, didn't I? Yeah. Yeah. You respond at a social level, at a medical level. You do everything you have to in the medical world. So that's at that kind of what we call the conventional reality. go to the doctor and do all that. But then as a spiritual exercise, you look at your the resistance to this awful situation, say, the fear, whatever, and you see, can you come to a sense of acceptance? But it's not, you might be quite, like, let's say I get cancer, I might be very aggressive with chemotherapy to deal with the cancer, right? At a social conventional level. But then in my heart, I keep practicing, oh, this is what it feels like to be afraid of cancer. Or this is what, like, the awful feelings of chemotherapy feel like. Keep coming to a sense of accepting awareness around it. And I mean, that would be difficult, but at least that would be the kind of program which I tried to deal with. Yeah? And I think that is very important in Buddhism, that you have the social conventional reality, and then you have this continual spiritual contemplation and practice. Because if you miss out that social reality, Buddhism sounds very fatalistic or passive sometimes. But there's a whole active part of it, which is around altruism and social responsibility and so on. Shall we finish with a chant? Yeah? Take one of these sheets. Let's do the reflections on sharing blessings.